Please be advised, this episode does have content that some may find distressing. As always, listener discretion is advised, and it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 13. Albert Pierpont's first engagement as lead executioner would take place in October 1941. He arrived at Pentonville Prison before 4 p.m. the day before, in accordance with Home Office guidelines. Once inside, he was taken to the Governor's office. Here he was introduced to his assistant, Steve Wade, who had travelled down from Doncaster where he worked as a car salesman. This would be the first of many executions that the pair would undertake, and Albert later recalled that he found Wade to be a capable assistant. Albert got his first glimpse of the condemned man through the Judas Hall, a small opening which allowed him to peer into the cell where they awaited execution. This allowed him to assess the individual's physique, which he would use alongside the prison records of the person's height and weight to calculate the drop accurately. The executioner and his assistant were provided lodgings in the prison and set about preparing for the task they would undertake the following day, preparing the ropes and testing the drop, until Pierpont was satisfied that everything was exactly as it should be. They then left the chamber with a weighted sandbag attached to the rope, which would stretch the rope overnight. Waking the following morning at 6:30, Albert headed to the chamber and ensured that everything was still in order. Repeating his checks, he then drew the letter T on the trapdoor, the horizontal line of which would be where the prisoner's toes were positioned. Having completed this, he headed off to breakfast with Steve Wade, after which the pair convened at the Governor's office, ready to head down to the condemned cell at 8:55. The man was led out into the execution chamber. His arms and legs were secured with a leather strap, as his toes were lined up with the T on the trapdoor, and a wide hood was placed over his head, followed by the noose. As soon as Steve Wade had finished pinioning the legs, he stepped back off the trapdoor, and within an instant, Albert had released the lever, ending the life of Antonio Babe Mancini. Antonio Mancini had been a gang leader who ran a club in Soho, London, where he had gotten into an altercation with two rival gang members. During the fight, he stabbed the two men, but claimed it was an act of self-defence, a reasonable assertion given that the wounds had been primarily to the arm and shoulder, suggesting he hadn't intended to cause serious injury. However, one of the men passed away from his injuries, and Mancini was charged with his murder. At the trial, the jury took less than an hour to find him guilty, and despite three appeals against his sentence being lodged, they were all rejected. This led him to have the unenviable honour of being the first man to die at Albert Pierpont's hands. A year before the execution of Antonio Mancini, a new terror fell over Britain as the roaring engines of German airplanes rumbled in the dark skies above, raining down a swarm of bombs that devastated the inhabitants below in the numerous cities and towns that had become the enemy's targets. The government had already made preparations for these attacks. From the very early days of the war, children had been evacuated from largely populated areas, arriving by train to small villages where they would be cared for by strangers. Large public air raid shelters were constructed, while smaller Anderson shelters were built in people's gardens. These provided a place to seek safety when the sirens sounded, warning of the imminent threat of bombs. Blackouts were introduced on the 1st of September 1939, 2 days before the war officially began. Before sunset, all homes and businesses had to ensure that any sources of light could not be seen from outside of their property, resulting in thick black curtains or sheets of cardboard being placed over windows. Street lights, traffic lights, and vehicle headlights were specially fitted with devices that deflected the beam of light onto the ground rather than illuminating the area around them. Some lights were extinguished altogether. The whole purpose was to make it harder for the German pilots to identify their targets. Albert Pierpont recalled travelling to executions on trains with blacked-out windows, preventing him from enjoying the changing scenery that whizzed past as the train sped across the country. The blackouts were designed to offer protection from the German bombs, but the darkness was also the perfect cover for those with ill intentions, with one such individual gaining the moniker of the Blackout Ripper. The Blackout Ripper, otherwise known as Gordon Cummins, was born roughly 50 miles northeast of Albert Pierpoint's birthplace of Bradford, in the village of New Earswick, a place of historical importance as it was created by the philanthropist Joseph Rowntree, who along with his brother founded the Rowntree's Chocolate Factory in the city of York. Not only was Joseph a successful businessman, he was also interested in the well-being of his workers. Seeking to provide them with better housing, he purchased 150 acres of land just 2.5 miles from the city of York, where we would construct New Earswick, which would consist of brick-built houses that provided affordable accommodation, not only for his employees, but for any working-class person. By 1915, 175 houses had been constructed in the village, as well as green spaces where the villagers could gather. The community that Joseph Rowntree hoped to establish was growing, with people flocking to the area to take advantage of the quality housing and the clean air that was lacking in the cities. Among those who had settled in New Earswick were John and Amelia Cummins, who sought to raise their family in the rural setting. Amelia worked hard tending to the home and caring for the couple's 4 children, while her husband worked at a school for delinquent youths. He was a strict man and a devout Catholic, who expected his children to work hard in their studies and be well behaved. Their eldest son, Gordon, would be sent to receive a private school education in Llandovery in Wales, where he failed to make a lasting impression, with him being seen as an unremarkable student who was more interested in spending time with his friends than he was in his studies. Despite this lack of studious activity, he completed his schooling at the age of 16 with a diploma in chemistry. He would go on to enrol at Northampton College of Technology, but either due to the lack of interest in his subjects or a change of mind regarding his plans for the future, he dropped out in November 1932. For the next 3 years, Gordon would gain employment in various roles. He worked as a tanner in Northampton, where he remained for just over a year before being fired for poor timekeeping. He then found work in Newcastle as an industrial chemist, but this role only lasted for 5 months before he was once again let go. By the end of 1934, Gordon had headed south to London, where he started working at a clothing factory. The 20-year-old was enthralled by the city, a far cry from the sleepy village of his childhood. He especially enjoyed the various hotels and bars in the city's West End. Here he would start to reinvent himself, creating a new persona. He would tell those he met that he was the illegitimate son of a rich aristocrat, who paid him a regular allowance which allowed him to fund his lavish lifestyle. Gordon went as far as to begin speaking with a more distinguished accent, attempting to ditch all traces of his working-class roots. But he could not afford to live the life of the aristocracy, and to keep up appearances he resorted to theft and embezzlement. As he crafted his new image, his employers became increasingly frustrated with his lack of commitment to his job, with him proving to be unreliable when it came to timekeeping, and ultimately, just 4 months after arriving in London, Gordon once again found himself unemployed. In 1935, Gordon Cummins would join the Royal Air Force. His first role was as a rigger, which meant he was responsible for carrying out flight checks on the aircraft. Perhaps being in the Air Force gave him the purpose he was seeking, as he soon began to impress his senior officers. The problem Gordon had was he still insisted on acting as though he was of aristocratic birth. He came across as arrogant and boastful, particularly when it came to his alleged sexual conquests. His fellow officers found his attitude to be intolerable, and they would brand him with the nickname the Duke as a term of disdain. A year after he joined the RAF, Cummins would meet Marjorie Stephens at an air show, The two began dating, and just 7 months later, on the 27th of December, they would be married at the registry office in Paddington. Having tied the knot, they would settle down in a small flat in the London suburb of Barnes. Their relationship, however, would be tested by Gordon being deployed to various locations throughout the country, while Marjorie would remain at their London flat. Despite the distance, the couple would write to each other regularly, and Gordon would visit his wife whenever he had the opportunity. In September 1939, World War II began, and within a month, Gordon was deployed to Helensburgh in Scotland. He was hundreds of miles from his wife, and while she lingered with only her sister for company amidst the increasing fear of the war raging in Europe, Cummings was spending his downtime at the local pub. The handsome Air Force officer was charming and apparently wealthy, which made him very popular with women in the area. In April 1941, Gordon Cummings was relocated to Killearn in Wiltshire, where he progressed to the rank of a leading aircraftsman. He seemed to have found the career he had desired, but his ultimate goal was to become a Spitfire pilot. But while in Killearn, he would risk his career and marriage by patronising a brothel in Bath. Not only did this mean he was being unfaithful to Marjorie, who was now facing the daily threat of being killed by German bombs, but it was also an action which was forbidden by the RAF. While he was stationed in Killearn, three women would be attacked, with the first woman telling police that she had been assaulted by a man in an RAF uniform. He had attempted to forcibly remove her clothes, and had placed his hand on her neck and began to apply pressure. Unfortunately, this lady, along with the other two who had been attacked, were only able to state that he was an airman, and could not provide a more detailed description. Given the atrocious acts that Cummings would commit less than a year later, it could be speculated that he may have been responsible for these incidents. Two more attacks carried out in October 1941 would also be suggested as being crimes committed by Cummings. The first incident took place on the 15th of October 1941, when 19-year-old Maple Churchyard was found dead in the ruins of a bombed-out house. The teenager was naked and had been strangled. It was also believed that her killer had stolen the contents of her now-empty purse. Just 2 days later, on the 17th of October, a 48-year-old widow who dwelt alone in a house near Regent's Park in London would be brutally murdered in her own home. When police investigated the scene, it was clear that whoever had killed Edith Humphreys had likely been let into the property, as there were no signs of forced entry. It was also concluded that the killer had stolen some of Edith's jewellery. Gordon Cummings was known to have frequented both these areas when he headed out to the capital from Wiltshire, although again there has been no official connection made between these attacks and Gordon Cummings, there are some striking similarities between these and his known crimes. If he had been responsible for these murders, they would pale in comparison to the horrific attacks he would carry out just 4 months later. But before he committed the crimes that made him famous, Gordon Cummings would be deployed to Cornwall on the 10th of November 1941. While here, he would join the Blue Peter Social Club in Falmouth, where he offered to tend the bar on a number of occasions. This help was gladly accepted at first, but when it was discovered that he was giving out free drinks to his fellow officers, he was dismissed from the club. Soon after, the landlady found that jewellery had been stolen from her flat. Suspicion fell on Gordon Cummings, but police were unable to prove that he was involved. By January 1942, Gordon Cummings had become a proficient pilot, accruing over 1,000 hours in the air. He passed an aviation exam, which combined with his exemplary performance as an officer, earned him a transfer to the Aircrew Receiving Centre in Regent's Park, where he was stationed with 300 other men. The receiving centre was based at Lord's Cricket Ground, which had been acquired by the Air Force during the war to receive and train recruits. Located next to the 395-acre Regent's Park, where the famous London Zoo is found, the restaurant of which was commandeered to feed the RAF troops. Blocks of flats that lined Prince Albert Road, which overlooked the park, were used as accommodation by the hundreds of servicemen. It was here at 10 a.m. on the 2nd of February 1942 that Gordon Cummings reported for duty. Just 6 days later, he would claim his first victim, whom he would counter lost to where the infamous Tyburn Tree once stood, from where convicts had once been publicly hanged. Evelyn Hamilton was born on the 8th of February 1901, and she would die on the same day 41 years later. She had been raised alongside her three sisters by her widowed mother, Lucy. Despite the loss of her husband, Lucy had sought to provide her daughters with the best upbringing she could, which she was able to do because her husband had managed his money wisely. As such, the widow and her children were able to live a comfortable life in the small village of Wrighton, which lies to the east of the city of Newcastle. The four girls were able to access a good education, with Evelyn going on to attend the prestigious medical school in Edinburgh, where she studied chemistry and pharmacology. Evelyn was a highly intelligent woman who preferred to be surrounded by books rather than people. Shy and reserved, her focus was divided between caring for her family and her career as a chemist, which led to her working all over the country. But no matter where she was, she would write to her mother on a weekly basis. As winter 1941 descended, Evelyn moved to a boarding house in Romford, Essex, where she would secure a role as a manager of a chemist on the High Street. Here she would work until the 6th of February 1942. On this day, as a creature of habit, she followed her regular routine. Waking up at 7:30 that morning, she rode the bus to work and set about opening the store. However, it would be the last day that Yardley's Chemist would be open for business. It would be one of many businesses that would suffer under the economic strain that had been brought about by the Second World War, which had now been raging for 2 years. Losing her job was a huge blow to 41-year-old Evelyn. She suffered from insomnia and depression. But despite this, within 2 days, she had managed to secure a new job in the port town of Grimsby. She had swiftly made arrangements for her minimal belongings to be sent to the town, with her planning on catching a train into London, and from there she would head north to begin her new job. Just 2 days after being dismissed, slightly built 5'3" Evelyn would board the train to London. The city was loud and bustling, a stark contrast to her nature. She was a wallflower who perhaps inadvertently had always found herself seeking peace and solitude. And so alone she arrived in the capital at 9:40 at night on the 8th of February 1942. At Aldgate Station she boarded the underground train to Baker Street Station, which sits to the southwest corner of Regent's Park. The air was filled with winter chill and a blanket of snow lay on the ground as Evelyn joined the crowds of people hurrying into the dark city, where all the lights were dimmed, casting long unfriendly shadows. Her lodgings for the night was a hotel located on Gloucester Place, and although it was less than a 10-minute walk from the station, the cold and her heavy luggage made her opt to take a taxi to the hotel instead. Having checked into the hotel, she took her suitcase to her single room, where she would be staying the night before carrying on her journey the following day. But sleep was far from her mind, as she had grown hungry from her travels. With the hotel's restaurant closed, Evelyn headed out in the cold, dark night, summoning a taxi to take her to the Maison Lyon's corner house, the once famous tea rooms located by Marble Arch. Here she was witnessed by one of the waitresses, who remembered seeing the woman enter the lawn at around midnight, who sat in solitude, ordering a glass of white wine, some bread and beetroot. What is puzzling about her movements that evening was that the police were unable to discover where Evelyn had been in the time between her leaving her hotel at 10 to 11 and her entering the tea rooms at midnight. This left a gap of approximately an hour unaccounted for, considering that her journey from the hotel to the restaurant would have taken no more than 5 minutes. With no witnesses to her whereabouts, this remains a mystery, as would be how she ended up in the location she was found deceased. No one saw Evelyn leave the tea rooms, so no one could confirm whether she was alone when she exited. or if she had encountered her killer along the route back to the hotel, which was a 12-minute walk from the cafe. Another question lingered. Why had she not caught a taxi back to the hotel? Did she not have enough money for the fare, or was there simply none available? Or had Evelyn met someone who offered to walk with her, a fellow northerner perhaps, who made her feel safe? These are perfectly reasonable things to wonder given the fixed snow on the ground, the icy conditions, and the fact that it was now after midnight. Again, these are thoughts that will remain unanswered. Evelyn failed to return to her hotel that night. Her suitcase remained packed, and the bed had never been slept in. Because she lay 140 yards away inside a public air raid shelter located on Montague Place. This narrow thoroughfare, with towering terraces lining either side, with many windows looking out onto the street, were silent witnesses to the events of that night. For the road would have been shrouded in darkness, and the thick blackout curtains were drawn across the glass panes, preventing light from leaking out, and potential witnesses from seeing Evelyn's plight. The sun had barely risen above the horizon on the morning of the 9th of February 1942, when two men heading to work, with their hands deep in their pockets for warmth and coat collars pulled up about their necks, walked briskly across a fresh layer of fallen snow. Their route took them past the three air raid shelters which were located on Montague Place. Their attention was drawn to the shelter located in the middle, before which a green hat lay beside a broken torch. Beyond this, just within the entranceway to the shelter, a leg protruded. Edging closer, the two men realised they were looking upon the body of a woman, still wearing her beige coat and a green and orange scarf, part of which had been placed in her mouth. She lay on her front, on the cold, damp pavement, just inside a place many came to rely on for safety. The police investigation would begin within half an hour of the discovery. Their efforts would be thwarted by a lack of clues at the scene, and as yet unanswerable questions. Who was this woman? They could find no identification on her person, and she did not appear to have a handbag with her. Who had killed her and why? Had she been the victim of a mugging? This would explain the absence of a handbag, but the victim was wearing what appeared to be an expensive gold watch. And the other questions. What was she doing in the shelter? Had she fled there to get away from her attacker? Scuff marks on her shoes suggested she may have been dragged, but a fresh layer of snow had removed any signs of this possibility. Perhaps the deceased woman had gone there willingly. Shelters were not only used for protection during a bombing raid. Sometimes they were the haunts of the homeless, or couples seeking a private space. A sexual motive had to be considered, given the manner in which Evelyn's body was found. Her breasts were exposed, her skirt had been pulled up over her waist, and her undergarments had been partially removed, while her legs were positioned apart, leading investigators to believe that her killer had deliberately posed the body. It was evident that she had not been a willing participant, as signs of her fighting against her attacker were clear. There was dislodged mortar which had fallen from the brick walls that now lay about her on the floor, and the scuff marks on her shoes and the wounds on her arms. This struggle may have been what caused her watch to stop at 1 o'clock. Despite her diminutive size and weighing only 7 stone, Evelyn Hamilton had fought for her life in that dark, damp shelter, just 100 yards away from her warm, yet empty hotel room. During inquiries, the police would speak to Miss Kathleen Jones, who was the manager of the hotel on Gloucester Place, where Evelyn had checked in on the night of the 8th of February. But the 41-year-old had failed to check out the following day as she had planned. Upon hearing the news that a woman's body had been discovered close to the hotel, Kathleen advised the police of her missing guest. Due to Evelyn being found without any identification, the hotel owner was asked to perform the task of viewing the remains at the mortuary. Having looked upon the petite, light brown-haired woman who lay before her, she was able to confirm that the deceased was her missing guest, an identification she could make with confidence, as Evelyn had stayed at the hotel on numerous occasions. However, the police would also ask for Evelyn's sister Kathleen and her former manager from the chemist to also corroborate this identification. Evelyn's post-mortem was carried out by the renowned pathologist Sir Bernard Spilsbury. He noted her numerous injuries. She had grazes on her legs, head, neck and back, a small cut above her left eye, and bruising to her right cheek. Her attacker had also inflicted a number of cuts to Evelyn's right breast. Sir Bernard noted the telltale signs of manual asphyxiation, including swelling of her facial features, a broken larynx, and more significantly, the existence of bruising on her neck, which clearly showed the outline of a thumb and four fingers from a left hand. It was concluded that Evelyn Hamilton had died at approximately 1 a.m. on the morning of the 9th of February 1942, consistent with the time that her watch had stopped, and the last known sighting of her at the cafe near Marble Arch. Despite the initial belief that a sexual assault had occurred, which had come from the way Evelyn's clothing had been disturbed, there were no traces of semen on the body, although there were signs of blood around her genitalia, which at the time perplexed the investigating officers. The crime scene yielded no further clues that could help progress the investigation, with no traces of prints and no witnesses who could confirm seeing or hearing anything at the time. The case may have gone cold, had it not been for the fact that Evelyn's killer had already claimed another victim. Gordon Cumming's second murder would take place on the night of the 9th of February 1942. Just 24 hours after he took the life of Evelyn Hamilton. His second victim was also called Evelyn, and she too had come from the north of England, born in the village of Earby, which I am very familiar with as I lived there from the age of 8 until I was 14. At the time of Evelyn's birth in 1907, it was a small hamlet located alongside the now disused Skipton-Tacombe Railway, dominated by three mills. There was still a very rural feel to the area, with the hillsides that rose above the village used for tending cattle, sheep and pigs. In 1913, the Empire Cinema opened in the village. Perhaps it was here that she became enthralled by the early film stars and dreamed of leaving her rural surroundings for the bright lights and possible fame of London. However, at the age of 15, this ambition came close to being ended before they had begun, when the teenagers discovered that she was pregnant. A scandalous situation for an unwed girl to find herself in, and she suffered the disapproving stares and gossip of the close-knit community. Knowing she could not care for the child, and with no support from the father who has never been identified, Evelyn was forced to give up the baby. The teenager had few prospects. Having left school at 14, and coming from a poor family, she had few opportunities to escape her small village life, and her marriage prospects were slim, as she was now viewed as an unfit match due to her pregnancy. Evelyn and Albert Pierpoint shared a desire to escape, with the former dreaming of stardom, while the latter sought to follow his father's footsteps. In 1932, both had the opportunity to take a step towards their goals. As Albert began his role as assistant executioner, Evelyn found her way out of the village of Earby, moving 50 miles to the west. She relocated to Thornton, which sits close to the seaside town of Blackpool. Here she had met Harold Ortley, a poultry farmer who didn't just offer Evelyn a chance to leave her rural village, he would also assist her in pursuing her dreams of stardom, although he feared that her hopes would be dashed and that she was ill-prepared for the dangers that she could encounter in the city. But he loved her and wanted Evelyn to be happy, and so he paid for the then 27-year-old to move to London. Her new accommodation was small and squalid, but she was a resilient girl who was spurred on by her dreams. She was also attractive, with a round face, blonde wavy hair and a pleasant smile. But good looks and talent did not always mean success in the West End, and like many young women who head to the big city, she found herself waiting tables and dancing in often seedy venues, including the Windmill Theatre in Soho, where she was employed as a topless dancer, still clinging to the hopes that one day she could leave that life behind. By 1936, having been in the city for almost 2 years, the poverty and depravity of the city had taken its toll on the once-spirited Evelyn, whose dreams had been crushed by repeated rejections, and her only source of income came from being a topless dancer for men who made her feel worthless. Defeated by the city, she headed back to Thornton, where Harold Oatley had been waiting for her. In the spring of that year, the pair were married, and Evelyn settled down to life as the wife of a farmer. Harold was an honest, hard-working man. He worked from dawn till dusk in order to provide for himself and his wife. But she had grown restless. Despite having her dreams crushed by the darker aspects of the city, she had also fallen in love with its busy streets and bright lights, and found herself wishing to be there once more. The mundane life of a farmer's wife in a quiet little house, with a husband's preferred routine and nights in, was not what Evelyn desired. She wanted excitement, noise and unpredictability. She fled back to London, leaving Harold behind to run his failing farm. And here she lived a life of independence, doing what she wanted when she wanted, and having relationships despite still being married. Evelyn thrived on her newfound freedom. With the outbreak of the Second World War, 35-year-old Evelyn was living in Wardour Street in Soho. She lived in one room on the first floor, with a kitchen and bathroom shared with the other flats. Her simple lodgings were sparsely furnished, with a sofa to sit on, a double bed for sleeping, and a small washstand. She was kept warm by a gas fire, and her only source of entertainment came from the wireless radio. For Evelyn, this Spartan way of living was just the price she had to pay to be close to the heartbeat of the city. Separated from her husband, she had a number of relationships, but Harold was always the man she would run to when things went wrong, and he would regularly travel to London to visit her. Unbeknownst to him, Evelyn had a secret life. Perhaps she was too ashamed to tell him that she was no longer working as a dancer, or he was unable to support her financially since Harold's farm had failed, and now, destitute and homeless, he had been forced to move back in with his mum. Whatever the reasons she had for not telling her estranged husband, he would discover after her death that for 6 years, Evelyn had been earning a living as a sex worker. It would be through this work that she would meet Gordon Cummins, a tall, charming and attractive airman with piercing blue eyes, who for a brief time gave her the attention Evelyn's friends claimed she craved, but he would also take her life. Just over a mile from where police were carrying out inquiries regarding the death of the yet unidentified woman in the air raid shelter, Evelyn Oatley headed out to her usual spot on Regent Street, where she would wait for clients. The sun had faded fast, and the biting cold had forced many to hurry to the warmth of their homes. By 10:15 that night, the impenetrable darkness of the blackout was in effect. But Evelyn lingered in her black jacket, skirt and boots, with the only pop of colour coming from her red jumper that poked out from above the collar of her jacket, which she pulled up about herself in an attempt to stay warm. The last sighting of Evelyn was at 11:40 that evening, when she was witnessed by Ivy Poole, who lived in the flat opposite. She recalled Evelyn was in the company of a tall man who wore a brown suit, which picked up the tortoiseshell accents on the rims of his glasses. Ivy observed as her neighbour disappeared into the little room and the door closed. Evelyn's radio was switched on, the volume turned up to drown out the sounds that may have emitted from within. Ivy was woken the following morning at roughly 8:20 by the sound of knocking on the door. She opened it to find Charles Fleming and George Carter, who had come to collect the money from the electric meters. They had already tried Evelyn's door, but had received no answer. So after calling on Ivy, they planned to try again, but without success. However, a small chink of light between the door and the frame made the trio aware that it was slightly ajar. Although the two men were known to Evelyn, she may have been startled by them, so Ivy opted to go in first to check on her neighbour. The room was in darkness, with a curtain still drawn across the window. Evelyn's electricity was connected to a coin-operated meter, which must have run out of money during the night, as when the trio attempted to switch the light on, nothing occurred. Despite the din, they were able to make out the silhouette lying on the bed. although it wouldn't be until George turned on his torch that they were able to see the lifeless body of Evelyn Ortley. She lay on her front, positioned diagonally on her double bed with her legs apart, dressed in a silk nightgown which had been pulled up over her hips. Officers arrived swiftly and were struck by the sadistic nature of the attack. Evelyn's throat had been cut and her abdomen had been mutilated. The subsequent autopsy estimated that Evelyn had been deceased for approximately 4 hours due to the fact that she was showing signs of rigor mortis. It also revealed that there had been an attempt to strangle Evelyn, and it was surmised that when this had failed, the killer had instead slit her throat with a razor blade, which had been found nearby. Also discovered on the bed beside the deceased woman was a tin opener, which was believed to have caused the abdominal mutilation. Apart from the clear signs of violence that were apparent on the bloodstained bed, the rest of the room seemed remarkably tidy, given the seemingly frenzied nature of the attack. There were no signs that a struggle had occurred due to the lack of anything being broken or knocked over, and it was believed that Evelyn had let her killer in. Initially, to the investigators, it appeared as though Evelyn had entered the room, got undressed, placed her day clothes neatly on a chair, her keys upon the fireplace, and climbed into bed to settle down for the night. The room didn't appear to have been ransacked, except for a broken lock on the wardrobe, where Evelyn kept her coat and handbag, the latter of which had been emptied and items had been taken including money and a metal cigarette case which contained a picture of Evelyn's mother. The absence of signs the perpetrator had searched the room for these valuables suggested that they knew where Evelyn kept her handbag. Had they seen her place it there prior to the attack? Or was her killer someone who knew her and was familiar with her routine of placing the bag in the wardrobe? The lining of the bag yielded one vital clue left behind by the offender, a fingerprint, along with another print which was lifted from the can opener. Sadly, at the time, there was no computer database that could be searched, just paper records, which made finding a match the equivalent of looking for a needle in a haystack. And that was assuming the perpetrator had been arrested and printed previously. One thing that was clear to the investigators was that this had not been a random robbery, given the lack of disarray in the room and the fact that there were still items of value present. Whoever had committed the murder had done so with the intention of inflicting serious injury to his victim, whom it was suspected had let him into her room. As police descended on Evelyn Ortley's flat, less than a mile away, Margaret Law had started her day, running a few errands in preparation for her daughter's visit that weekend. Every 3 weeks, 15-year-old Barbara would travel by train from the orphanage in Southend-on-Sea in order to see her mother in London. It was a reunion the two eagerly looked forward to. The previous years had not been kind to them, and it was the one glimmer of light in their otherwise bleak lives, which explained Margaret's unusual cheerful demeanour that morning, as she visited the shops where staff had become used to her abrupt and seemingly aloof nature. Margaret had experienced incredible highs and devastating lows in her 43 years of life. Born in 1899 in the coastal town of Napier, New Zealand, a place of clear blue skies and turquoise seas, described by the Mayor John Brown in a tourist brochure in 1908 as, quote, a charming city, an ideal holiday resort, with fine weather almost a certainty for the visitor in search of change and rest. Margaret's family lived a comfortable life, but this all changed when her parents moved, with Margaret and her 3 siblings, to the East End of London. This is where their fortunes changed. At the outbreak of the First World War, Margaret's father was called up to fight, but he would never return, leaving his widow to care for 4 children, and burdened by debt. Margaret's teenage years were far removed from the life she had known in New Zealand, living in a lodging house with her mother and 3 siblings, weighed down by poverty. She had little prospects, having left school in order to work to help support her mother. The teenager worked long, arduous hours, and as the years passed by, New Zealand was nothing more than a distant memory. At the age of 20, she had resorted to sex work in order to survive. While operating under the alias of Peggy Campbell, she was convicted of, quote, living off the immoral earnings of prostitution, for which she was fined 20 shillings. Her fortunes would, however, change in October 1921 when she married 40-year-old Frederick Lowe, with whom she would move to the coastal town of Southend-on-Sea, where they would run a profitable shop. Margaret had regained some of what she had lost when her family had moved from New Zealand. She had returned to living by the sea, and was now leading a comfortable life with her loving husband, a successful business, and in 1928, at the age of 29, she would give birth to her daughter Barbara. But her blessed life would be torn away from her once more, when on the 14th of December 1932, Frederick Lowe died. Devastated by the loss, Margaret spiralled into a deep depression, resorting to drink to numb the pain of her grief. Unable to cope, she lost the business and her home, forcing her to place 6-year-old Barbara into an orphanage. Destitute, she returned to London in 1934, hoping to rebuild her life. She managed to find work as a cleaner, but this would be the first of many dead-end jobs with limited pay, and gave her no hopes of being able to provide for herself and her daughter. By 1942, Margaret was back on the streets selling her body in exchange for money. She had accrued 3 convictions for soliciting, always using an alias. It wasn't the life she wanted. She once referred to sex work as, quote, dirty piece of work. But it allowed her the chance to see her daughter every 3 weeks, and gave her shelter, clothing and food. It also paid for the alcohol that she had grown to depend on years earlier following her husband's death. Despite her fall into poverty, Margaret still retained the image of prosperity, being well-spoken, impeccably dressed, and carrying herself with an air of sophistication. She was also a solitary figure, keeping to herself, only working after 11 o'clock at night. She conducted her business with discretion. Meeting her clients, she would take them back to her ground floor flat on Gosfield Street, under the cloak of darkness and silence. The 5'3" brunette may have appeared maternal and gentle, but she also knew how to handle clients who stepped out of line, often seen calling them out of their behaviour, and not afraid to resort to violence in order to protect herself. She had thought off an attacker just 2 weeks before her death, when her client, a Canadian soldier, attempted to sexually assault her. She fought him off, and her calls for help were heard by her neighbours who came to her assistance. The attacker, however, fled, and fearing the repercussions of being caught conducting the unlawful act of prostitution, Margaret declined to make any formal reports to the police, leaving her attacker free and her body bruised. On the night of Tuesday the 10th of February, she would meet a client she was unable to fight off, whose sole intention was to take her life and desecrate her body in the same manner he had done the previous night, when he had murdered Evelyn Ortley in her flat, just a few streets away. Margaret was last seen walking the streets by another sex worker at 12:30 that night, in the same location as Evelyn had been the previous night, loitering on the corner of Shaftesbury Avenue and Piccadilly Circus. She was alone. However, at some point during the next half an hour, Margaret had encountered a man she would take back to her flat. The residents in the basement flat below Margaret's unit heard her returning home at 1:10 that morning and heard the soft conversation between Margaret and her client. But they did not hear any disturbance, nor screams, nothing to suggest that she had fought for her life. Her killer acted swiftly and silently, leaving the flat unseen. He locked the door behind him and disappeared into the darkness. Gordon Cummings would return to his billet that morning, his fellow officers unaware of his murderous deeds. That Wednesday night he would not stalk the streets for another victim, his prey spared by the fact that he had to report for duty. But the following night he would return to once again haunt the darkened thoroughfares of London, seeking out his next kill. 30-year-old Greta Haywood was an attractive petite blonde who was currently going through a divorce with her husband, whom she still lived with in Kingsbury, North West London. On the night of the 12th of February 1942, she caught a train into the city, arriving an hour after leaving home. Greta lingered for a time around the Criterion Theatre in Piccadilly Circus, where she had arranged to meet her date that night. It was freezing cold, with the icy wind turning Greta's cheeks and nose red, and causing her fingertips to tingle. She was an hour early, and while she paced trying to stay warm, Greta was approached by a charming gentleman dressed in the uniform of an air cadet. She told the handsome, fair-haired airman with piercing blue eyes that she was waiting for the man she was dating, who was an army officer. The airman seemed to accept this, and politely suggested that they went for a drink in the theatre bar to pass the time and be somewhere warmer. As they walked, she couldn't help recognise the man's distinctive accent, despite his attempts to hide it. She found it comforting, as it was the sound of her home county of Yorkshire. The pair headed into the bar inside the Criterion, where they had a glass of whisky each. But with time to spare and both admitting feeling hungry, Greta agreed to go for a bite to eat at a nearby restaurant, with the kindly officer offering to escort Greta back to Piccadilly Circus in time to meet her date. He made her feel comfortable, safe, and was acting like the perfect gentleman. They headed to a restaurant on the corner of Shaftesbury Avenue and Piccadilly Circus, which was owned by the same company that ran the Maison Lyonnaise, where Evelyn Hamilton had eaten prior to her death in the air raid shelter. As they sat and ate their meal, the seemingly charming airman's demeanour began to change. The more drink he consumed, the more flirtatious he became, turning to rudeness, and seemed to be unwilling to accept Greta's firm rejections and any advances he made. By the end of the meal, they had paid their bills, and Greta felt that he had finally understood that she was not interested. She felt comfortable enough to allow him to fulfil his promise to escort her back to the Criterion Theatre, with them heading out to the restaurant at 8:45. But now his gentlemanly guise began to slip. He made comments about how he'd once hurt a girl, which seemed like veiled threats, and she felt increasingly afraid in his presence. As he guided her down a narrow street beside the restaurant, with no one close by to signal for help, nearing Piccadilly Circus, but still on the dark, narrow back street called St. James's Market, the airman paused and asked if she would allow him a goodnight kiss, suggesting they could perhaps head to a nearby air raid shelter for some privacy. Despite her fear, Greta was still steadfast in her rejection of him, denying his request and stating that she would not go anywhere with him. They walked a little further, until they were in the darkest and most secluded spot. Then he struck, forcing Greta into the shadows of an enclosed doorway. He cast the bag containing his gas mask on the ground, and proceeded to force himself upon the now terrified woman, ignoring her pleas for him to stop. Her fear intensified as he placed his left hand about her neck and began to squeeze, gently at first, allowing Greta enough air to plead for her life. As he tightened his grip, she tried to fight, but he proved too strong as her body became deprived of oxygen, causing her to black out. Fortunately, she would not face the same fate as the women before her, as the attack would be interrupted by a night porter called John Shine, who happened to be in the right place at the right time, as he passed by on his way to deliver bottles to a nearby pub. He had heard an unusual noise emitting from the darkness of the passageway, and was drawn by the unusual movement of a torchlight. John cast the rays of his own torch into the darkness. It illuminated a shadowy figure looming over a woman who was slumped on the floor. Sensing that something was wrong, the young porter shouted, "Police!" causing the shadowy figure to flee off into the darkness. Greta had been rendered unconscious, but slowly she came to and was assisted to her feet by the man who had saved her life. Together they headed to the nearby police station. The injured woman staggered up to the desk, struggling to catch her breath, having suffered a fractured larynx, a head injury, and showing obvious signs of an assault. She was remarkably clear on what had occurred, and more importantly, she was able to provide a detailed description of the man who had assaulted her, having spent nearly an hour with him, and she had heard his Yorkshire accent, despite his futile efforts to disguise it. She had also noticed many other details about him, and described the man to the officer as, quote, "a British airman,
aged 30-ish, 5'9" tall, clean-shaven, soft features, light blue eyes, slim build, fair-haired, dressed in a Royal Air Force blue uniform with long black greatcoat, a woolen side cap with a white cadet's emblem, and over his left shoulder he carried a black gas respirator in a beige canvas bag. This final detail would prove crucial, as all gas respirators issued to servicemen had their own unique code written inside them, which was linked to the officer's name. It was a mistake that Gordon Cummins had realised very quickly could lead to him being apprehended, and in an act of desperation, he stole another officer's mask. His desire to kill, however, had not been quelled, and with an hour of attacking Greta, he would approach 25-year-old Catherine Mulcahy, whom he encountered on Regent Street, just a matter of minutes' walk away from where he had attacked Greta. Catherine came from a large Irish family. Her dad was a violent drunk, and she barely knew her mother. At first glance, one might believe that she was timid, but Catherine had a fiery temperament. From a young age, she had learnt to be tough, which had helped her to survive. She had recently fled an abusive relationship, and was hoping for her divorce to be finalised imminently. Not only did she have to muster the strength to leave her husband, she also had to face the prospect of living day to day, pondering where she would live, how she would earn enough money, not only for herself but her child. Catherine knew she couldn't provide for them both, and in an act of heartbreaking selflessness, she decided to give up her child for adoption, in the hopes that they would get the life that she could not offer. It was just after 10 o'clock that night when the tall, red-haired Catherine met Gordon Cummins. Having turned to sex work to pay the rent, she saw him as just another client, with whom she agreed a price before the pair caught a taxi back to her flat on Suffolk Street, half a mile from the air raid shelter on Montague Place, where Evelyn had been slain 4 nights before. Arriving at her second floor flat, her lodgings similar to those of Gordon's other victims, furnished with the bare essentials, she closed the door and Catherine proceeded to undress, with her client watching her with a strange smile. As she lay on the bed, he moved to join her. Catherine knew she was in trouble when he knelt on her abdomen, pinning her to the bed. As he placed his hands around her neck, she pushed him off her, but he was unrelenting in his quest, as he tried to pin her down again. She kicked him. Intentionally or not, Catherine had not removed her boots, and this blow to his stomach was enough to knock her assailant off the bed, giving her time to escape. Managing to get to the neighbouring flat, the occupant opened the door to see a terrified Catherine standing before them. Meanwhile, Gordon Cummins had hastily gotten dressed and exited the flat. Casually approached Catherine, handed her some money, and apologised, claiming, quote, "I'm sorry. I think I had too much to drink this evening." Perhaps he hoped that this would prevent Catherine from reporting the assault, out of fear of being prosecuted for prostitution. But she would report him, and evidence he left behind in the form of a belt from his RAF uniform would ultimately connect him to the crime. All officers are meant to report back to their lodgings by 10:30 in the evenings, having to sign in and out whenever they left. But Gordon, like many other service personnel, would simply have other officers sign on their behalf. So although the log showed that he was there at his billets, Cummins was still prowling the street. Having failed twice, his anger and desire had intensified. He needed to take another life. Gordon's sixth and final victim would be Doris Joannet. Acquaintances believed she was French due to her surname, while clients perceived her to have the appearance of a Russian. However, she was neither. Doris was another northerner, having been born just 5 miles from the city of Newcastle, in the village of Leamington. Incidentally, this is just 4 miles away, on the opposite side of the River Tyne, to the village of Wrighton, where Gordon Cummins' first victim, Evelyn Hamilton, was born. At the time of Doris's birth in 1907, Leamington was a thriving industrial village, with the air being polluted by the various factories, churning out iron, brick and glass. There were also numerous coal mines located in the area. These factories and mines were built in close proximity to the River Tyne, which was utilised to transport goods into the city of Newcastle and beyond. Soon after delivering Doris, her mother, 41-year-old teacher Elizabeth, passed away. With her father unknown, the infant ended up in the care of her aunts, Isabella and Mary, who would raise their niece in the port town of Hartlepool. In the intervening years, not much is known of what happened to Doris. That is until August 1935, when the then 25-year-old was reported as dwelling in London, where she met 60-year-old Frenchman Henri Zoinette. It has been alleged that the pair met while Doris was operating as a sex worker. However, within 3 months, the pair were married, and Henri was able to offer the orphan child of an unwed mother a chance at something she could have only dreamed of. Due to his wealth, accumulated from his successful group of hotels, he was not only able to shower her with affection, expensive gifts and beautiful clothes, but they drove around in a Rolls Royce and had a beautiful home with staff to attend to her needs. They had a good life for a short while. The economic crash of the 1930s, combined with the outbreak of the Second World War, had a detrimental impact on the tourist trade, with hotels struggling to stay open. By 1942, Henri's business was in ruins. Struggling with mounting debts, he was forced to give up his business, the luxury car and their home in Eastbourne. With the limited money they had remaining, they moved to a ground floor flat in Sussex Gardens. Short on money, 67-year-old Henri took on a role at the Royal Court Hotel in Sloane Square, which he once owned, but now worked there as the manager. His days were long, and it was expected that he slept at the hotel. Therefore, most nights he would enjoy an evening meal with Doris, heading back to the hotel by 9:30. He loved his wife and believed that they were happy, despite their financial hardships. But people who were acquainted with Doris had told a different story, of a woman afraid of losing her financial security and returning to a life of poverty. And so, when she needed money, she turned to the one thing that had seen her through the tough times of her early 20s. She returned to working on the streets. On the 12th of February 1942, the couple followed the same routine, with Henri returning home for his dinner at 7 o'clock that night. And despite the bitterly cold weather and the darkness of the blackout, Doris joined her husband on the short walk to Paddington train station, where she bid him farewell. Henri boarded the train, believing his wife was heading straight home, unaware that she had other plans that night. As Doris headed away from the station, she would be seen by numerous people, who confirmed that she did not return to her house. Instead, Doris met a friend in the Maison Lyonnaise, which overlooked Marble Arch, where Evelyn Hamilton ate her final meal. While enjoying a drink in the cafe, Doris confided to her friend Beatrice that her marriage was an unhappy one. She no longer shared a bed with her husband, and he was struggling to support them financially. As Gordon Cummins climbed into a taxi with Catherine Mulcahy, Doris and Beatrice exited the cafe, with Doris having plans to meet with a wealthy client that evening. She and Beatrice parted ways. At roughly 11 p.m, Gordon made a hasty exit from Catherine Mulcahy's home, while at the same time, Doris was making her way back to her house, just a 5-minute walk away in Sussex Gardens. Whether Doris encountered Cummins en route is uncertain. However, somehow he was able to gain entry to her ground floor flat, where, as before, there were no signs of forced entry or any indication that a struggle had taken place. It appeared as though Doris had entered the house, placed her coat and bag in their usual place, calmly undressed, neatly folded her clothes before climbing into bed for the night. The following day, and less than 2 miles away, 15-year-old Barbara Law arrived at Margaret Law's flat, eagerly anticipating spending the weekend with her mother. The teenager was perturbed when she found the door was locked and no answer came from within. Leaning against the doorframe was a parcel, which according to neighbours had been there for 3 days, and none of them could recall seeing Margaret during that time. Unable to gain entry and overwhelmed with concern and unable to think straight, the only thing Barbara could do was call the police. When an officer arrived at 4:30, He located a spare key under the doormat. It is possible that in her panic state, Barbara had forgotten about its existence. However, in hindsight, it was fortunate that she hadn't unlocked the door. Nothing would have prepared the 15-year-old for the scene that met officers. At first, it appeared as though a burglary had occurred, with the contents of drawers and cupboards strewn about the kitchen. But upon gaining entry to the dark bedroom, the officers' torches illuminated the desecrated body of Margaret. As with the other crime scenes, the bedroom appeared undisturbed, with the culprit focusing his attention solely on his victim. Margaret had been struck across the face with a fire poker with such ferocity that the handle of the implement had broken. Her body lying diagonally across the bed, she was partially clothed, with her black stockings wrapped tightly about her neck. And as with his previous victims, he had proceeded to mutilate the body, ripping open her abdomen. But it was clear his depraved desires had escalated, as his desecration of Margaret's body was more vicious than before. That Friday the 13th would bring ill fortune to another loved one, as just a couple of hours after Margaret's body was found, having been at work at the hotel for 12 hours, tired and hungry, Doris's husband, Henri, arrived home at around 7 p.m. That morning's milk delivery was still on the doorstep, and when he entered the flat, the remnants of the previous night's dinner were still on the table. As the elderly man made his way through the flat, he called out to his wife, but got no response. Finding the bedroom door locked, with no key and no strength to open it, Henri suspected that something was wrong and contacted the police. What lay beyond that bedroom door was a scene that would haunt those who viewed it, and bore all the hallmarks of a blackout ripper attack. She would be his final victim. The killer had taken the lives of 4 women and attacked 2 others in the space of a week. He had left behind vital clues which allowed investigators not only identify him, but confirm that Gordon Cummins had committed the atrocious crimes. In the early hours of Friday the 13th of February, while Doris and Margaret remained undiscovered, police had tracked down the owner of the respirator that had been left behind after the attack on Greta Haywood. He was brought in for questioning at 5:45 that Friday morning regarding the assault. Initially, he denied any involvement, claiming that his gas mask must have accidentally been picked up by another officer, and it was them who had committed the assault. However, his demeanour changed when police advised they were going to conduct an identity parade. Having spent an hour in her company, Cummins may have realised that Greta would be able to positively identify him, which caused him to admit to assaulting her. The airman blamed his actions on the excessive amount of alcohol he had consumed that night. His admission led to him being charged with assault and held in custody pending further investigation. The following day, a full search of his accommodation was conducted, including acquiring a logbook, which all officers had to register the time at which they came and went from the building. On the surface, these appeared to give Gordon Cummins the perfect alibi, as it looked as though he had been in the residence at the times the attacks had occurred. But when investigators dug a bit deeper, they learned that many of the entries had been faked by Gordon's flatmates, who admitted that they often covered for each other by falsifying the log. Another cadet admitted that he and Gordon had often left their accommodation after lights out had been declared, leaving via a fire escape to go out drinking around the areas where the victims had frequented. A search of Gordon's belongings also revealed items that connected him to the murders. It seemed as though he had been collecting mementos, including wristwatch, comb and pen, which were identified by Henri as belonging to his wife, Doris. 15-year-old Barbara Law identified a cigarette case that belonged to her mother, Margaret, while another cigarette case was identified as one belonging to Evelyn Otley and was found to contain a picture of the deceased woman's mother. Cummins had left clues behind at the crime scenes, including his own fingerprints on the tin opener that had been used to mutilate Evelyn Otley, and prints that were found on the candlestick which had been used to violate Margaret Law. When he attacked Catherine Mulcahy, he left her lodgings in such haste that he left behind the belt from his uniform, which, like other items of his clothing, were later found to have traces of blood on them. And the money he had given to Catherine in an attempt to prevent her from reporting the assault also provided a link back to him, as serial numbers on the notes matched his pay records. The most crucial piece of evidence, which ultimately led to his capture, was the respiratory mask, which he had inadvertently left when he fled the scene of Greta Hayward's assault. But the mask also had small amounts of mortar dust, consistent with that found in the air raid shelter where Evelyn Hamilton had been murdered. This combined with his suggestion to Greta that they should head to a shelter for more privacy helped police to connect Evelyn Hamilton's murder to the series. Another crucial witness came forward having taken Cummins home as a client on Thursday the 12th of February, the night when he assaulted Greta Hayward, Catherine Mulcahy, and would go on to murder Doris Ronett. This witness claimed she had returned home with a man matching Cummins' description. However, when the airman became aware of her pimp hiding in the room, he fled. This likely saved her life, but in doing so fanned the flames of Gordon's murderous desire. On the 27th of April 1942, Gordon Cummins stood trial, charged solely with the murder of his second victim, Evelyn Ortley. This was a strategic decision which would have allowed him to be tried for the other murders should he be acquitted for Evelyn's murder. Bearing in mind it would be another 63 years before the abolition of the double jeopardy law, which would allow for an individual to be tried twice for the same crime. The evidence against Gordon Cummins was compelling, particularly the fingerprint comparisons, which seemed to remove any doubt from the jurors' minds. A trial only lasted for a day, with the jury reaching a verdict in just 35 minutes. 24 hours later, Gordon Cummins was sentenced to death. Correspondences between Gordon and his family reveal that he continued to protest his innocence, claiming that evidence had been planted, and he believed that the real killer was another Air Force cadet called Raymond Beetham, who had a criminal record and had been missing from the officers' accommodations during the times the murders had taken place. Cummins was adamant that he had been framed for the crimes. Convinced that he was innocent, his family launched an appeal, garnering support from some highly influential people, including the Archbishop of Canterbury, who wrote a letter to Home Secretary Herbert Morrison, voicing his own concerns regarding the case. The Archbishop argued that people close to the case had raised concerns regarding the precarious nature of the evidence presented, and that the actions of the murderer did not match with the character of Gordon Cummins, as described by those who knew him best. Despite these pleas for leniency, the Home Secretary decreed that the death sentence would be served, and Albert Pierpoint was called upon to carry out the duty as the executioner. On the 25th of June 1942 at Wandsworth Prison, Gordon Cummins was led into the execution chamber, where he stoically stood with his feet lined up on the T marking on the trapdoor, his head covered with the white hood, arms and legs pinioned, and the rope placed about his neck. At 8 a.m, as an air raid siren broke the silent air, the trapdoor swung open, and Gordon Cummins, the Blackout Ripper, fell into the dark drop. To Albert Pierpoint, he was just performing his duty, but it will never be known what drove Cummins to embark on his murder spree. As far as I could tell, there was nothing in his background to suggest he was capable of committing these heinous crimes. What made him go out on that Sunday night and take the life of Evelyn Hamilton, his first victim, and then go on to murder Evelyn Ortley, Margaret Law, and Doris Ronett? Gordon Cummins' crimes were relatively underreported at the time, due to many factors, including restrictions on what was allowed to be reported, scarce resources, and possibly the fact that within the space of a week, he had committed 4 murders, 2 assaults, and was apprehended, which didn't allow reporters much time to become aware of the story as it was unfolding. The reports that were produced at the time had very little information regarding the crimes, and later articles have conflicting information. Therefore, I have tried to stick with what was most consistent, I'm also aware that the women who were killed went by other names. However, for clarity, I have stuck with the names they were primarily known by.
So in the meantime, keep an eye on those shadows.